Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, if you listen to this program regularly, you'll know my enthusiasm for the positives of AI, even though I recognize lots of the negatives. And so I have set up a program called Get Started with AI to help people learn how to use these tools properly and safely. We have two events coming up. One is an online one for education and research. So if you work as an academic or work in education or research, it's an online one at the end of this month. And we also have an in-person bootcamp in Dublin for SME owners where we'll be fixing your problems in the room and showing you what these amazing tools can do. If that sounds like something you might be interested in, you can check out getstartedai.com. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us, we're at @newstalkscience. And now, Irish Astronomy Week runs Saturday, March 1st to Saturday, March 8th. You can find out details about all of the events on irishastronomyweek.ie. One of the speakers is Dr. Laura Hayes. She's from the Dias Dunsink Observatory. She's a solar physicist who's going to be talking about work on the Solar Orbiter and the European Space Agency and NASA. She joins us now. Laura, welcome to the programme. The Solar Orbiter is a very cool mission. Can you tell us a little bit about how long it's been running and what we're starting to see from it at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so maybe I'm a bit biased, but Solar Orbiter mission is my favorite mission. I'm a solar physicist, so I'm interested in all things about the sun and the solar activity. So the Solar Orbiter mission was actually launched in 2020. It's a European Space Agency mission in collaboration with NASA. And it was launched in 2020, and its main goals are really to do two things. It's going to take images of the sun in the closest up viewpoint we've ever seen, and it already is doing that. But also what's really unique about it is it's not only taking measurements and images of the sun, it's actually taking like measurements at the spacecraft, right? So the spacecraft itself can measure the magnetic field as it traverses around the sun. It can also measure the particles at the spacecraft. And another thing about Solar Orbiter is, like, as the name would suggest, it is orbiting the sun, but in a very different orbit to what we have on Earth. So it's going in this elliptical orbit around the sun, away from the sun-Earth line, and it's going to get in, it gets in super close. It gets in, you know, inside the orbit of Mercury, and it's also going out of the ecliptic plane. And what that means is it's getting a viewpoint of the poles of the sun. So it's been running now. So it was launched in 2020, and it's really its science mission phase started in 2021. And since then, it's been taking these unbelievably close images of the sun as it goes in really, really close. And it's also measuring the particles at the spacecraft. And this has never really been done before on one mission. So we can see what's happening on the sun and measuring those effects of the sun at the spacecraft, which is very, very cool. Or very, very hot, I guess, right? It's going super close.
It seems like it got to the sun pretty quickly. Like I hear a lot about planetary missions and, you know, the years it takes to get there. But it seems like the Solar Orbiter, even though it was, you know, going quite far, got there quite quickly. Why is that?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? So I guess one thing is, you know, the sun is relatively close to us in the solar system compared to going out, say, as far as Jupiter, which is another mission called JUICE, which was launched. And that's going to take several years to get to Jupiter. And I guess the way Solar Orbiter kind of runs, one of the hardest things is getting it into this trajectory or kind of the orbit to get in really close to the sun. And it's doing that really by kind of using these flybys of planets, which is super cool. So this is kind of an orbital dynamics thing where its orbit was shut off and essentially it's using flybys of Venus and of Earth to basically kind of slingshot it into its orbit, which is really nice. So this is what we call flybys. So there's several that happen at Venus, and this kind of gets it in close and out of the ecliptic plane, which is nice. So I guess the main thing is the sun is relatively close to us from Earth, and using kind of really cool orbital dynamics, we can do kind of nice engineering to kind of get into this nice orbit. So it gets to the sun, you know, in terms of getting really close to the sun, it does this twice a year. So twice a year, it gets in really close inside the orbit of Mercury, and then it slingshots back out around the orbit of Earth and then back in again. It's currently on its way back in. So in April this year, it's going to go back in really, really close to the sun. So a third of the distance from the Earth to the sun.
I just asked a really stupid question, but I appreciate you making it sound like it wasn't a stupid question. Why do we get to the sun quickly? Because it's very close. So the closeness is the question that I have. How close does it get? And what sort of things do you have to do to a spacecraft to allow it to perform in that sort of environment?
Yeah, so it's going to get into what we would call 0.3 astronomical units. So that's basically a third of the way in from Earth. So to kind of give you context there, you know, Mercury, which is the closest planet to the sun, is around 0.4 astronomical units, and this is going to less than 0.3. So the closest we've ever gone with an imaging spacecraft. And of course, as you mentioned, this is really challenging from an engineering perspective because you have really sensitive instruments on board that are going into a really, really hot and really, really energetic environment. So kind of the key things we really need to think about is having a heat shield to block most of the kind of sensitive detectors. And this was, again, which I think this is a nice connection to Ireland, this material that they had to build to put on the spacecraft to protect all the instruments on board is called a solar black. And it was actually created by an Irish company called Enbio. And another fun fact is that it's actually made out of ground up bones, I think bovine bones from a cow. So it's actually one of the first non-vegetarian spacecraft to be flown.
Wow.
So it's really nice. And this really does protect it from kind of the extreme heat that it faces as it gets in really, really close.
And so when it goes around the sun, does it always obviously has to keep that shield facing the sun the whole time. So it sort of swings its backside around, does it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it keeps that face the whole way, like every time it's kind of going close to the sun, that is the side facing it. And now there are, of course, little holes in it so that we can actually see things out of it. So we have kind of like little holes that the telescopes can open and take measurements then when it gets in really close.
And so what have we learned from the solar orbiter missions so far?
Yeah, so we've actually learned lots from different kind of science questions that Solar Orbiter was trying to understand. So, for example, you know, what generates the solar wind and what kind of creates and drives it? We also want to know, you know, how does the sun create these really energetic particles and flares and coronal mass ejections with these huge explosions in the solar atmosphere? But one of the really nice stories that came out this week and one of the big kind of science achievements was looking at how the solar wind, so this is this constant stream of energetic particles away from the sun. So if you think about a wind, right, you know, if you have a fire and steam blowing away or flames blowing away, this is basically the solar wind and it's continuously occurring. It interacts with Earth, it interacts with all the planets in the solar system. And we really want to understand, you know, what drives this? We really don't know. And that one of the nice stories this week was using measurements from Solar Orbiter by taking both images of the sun really close, it can see these tiny little energetic events happening on the sun called picoflares. And before, we were never able to really see them. And some of the big questions was, are these little energetic events occurring on the sun drive the solar wind? And what the scientists were able to do, and colleagues were able to look at the images of these and see these details, which we've never been able to see before, and then actually measure the solar wind at the spacecraft. So measuring those energetic particles at the spacecraft and measuring the magnetic field of the spacecraft to connect these tiny, tiny things happening at the sun to what's occurring then in the solar wind of the spacecraft. So we've actually been able to see what the origin of the fast solar wind and the slow solar wind is in connecting the dots, which has been really very exciting because before we weren't able to really distinguish about what is actually happening on the sun to drive this solar wind and the speed of the solar wind. So that's kind of one of the big results, I guess, from recent times.
There's a huge amount of magnetic activity that happens on the sun's surface or around the sun, right? And there's some unusual quirks of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess, you know, the sun has this cycle, right, which is called the solar cycle. And basically, it's kind of a way that the sun goes from having really kind of low activity, the magnetic field of the sun is pretty stable, to going to a maximum where this magnetic field of the sun gets really, really complicated and completely twisted up. And when it gets to this really completely twisted up phase, this is during solar maximum, we have large explosions that happen in the sun and we have more kind of streams of the solar wind. And when we have this really, really, if you think of an elastic band getting tightened up, that's what happens to the magnetic field of the sun during solar maximum. And basically these elastic bands can eventually snap and eject huge amount of energies into space. So they can cause like a magnetic field and plasma to fly off into space.
I think I've seen videos of that. That's really cool. Like it is exactly how you described it. It's like the snapping of a rubber band, and it just flings like giant amounts of sun goo.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Not the technical term, I believe, but sun goo into outer space.
Yeah. And actually the sun is actually currently coming up to this maximum again. So when Solar Orbiter was launched, the sun was quite quiet, not much going on, but it's now in its really big twisting phase. And there was two very large storms actually last year, which we actually saw in Ireland, right? We had these Aurora Borealis, or the Northern Lights that were seen in May last year and also in October. Mm. These were seen, you know, even in Dublin. And that was a direct impact of these large explosions that happened on the sun. This solar goo, as you say, kind of ejected away. It interacted with the Earth's magnetic field to actually cause these large, Northern Lights, which are beautiful. So it's kind of a nice way to connect, you know, things that are occurring on the sun really do have, you know, a beautiful impact on Earth, but also can have, adverse effect on Earth in terms of space weather and impacting our technology.
How will this mission end? Is it going to eventually spiral into the sun? Is that the plan? Like, are you just going to keep getting closer and closer and closer until the materials and the instruments don't work, or what's the plan?
Yeah, so it's not actually going to eventually go into the sun, but what it is going to do is actually going to go out of the. It kind of goes in kind of a tilted orbit continuously, and it will continuously tilt. And what I mean by that is, you know, again, I think I said before, we're on this ecliptic plane. So we are, if you imagine like a dinner plate, the sun's in the middle and we are also on this plate. So we've only ever had views of the sun from that perspective. We only see one face of the sun from the middle of it. But Solar Orbiter, using kind of this flybys or these slingshots with Venus, as it continuously goes on from even next year, it's going to get more and more out of this, off this plate, and kind of go closer and closer in terms of seeing, or more, it's seeing kind of different viewing angles of the sun.
Oh, wow.
So it's going to get more and more tilted, so it actually starts to observe the pole of the sun, or the top of the sun, which is something we've never been able to see before. So eventually we'll continuously do this for many, many years up until, you know, the 2030s. And then eventually, I guess it will just, you know, as spacecraft and instruments do, eventually it will run out of, you know, the detectors will fade and things like this.
It'll meet its heavenly father.
So, but no, it will never actually fall into the sun. It will just end up, you know, continuously orbiting its long life.
That's so cool. So when it finally gets above the plate to be able to look down on the poles of the sun, what will it see? I mean, I know there are some celestial bodies that have, that rotate and then spit out a huge amount of energy from the top and bottom. Is that what we see with the sun, or is it all fairly similar all the way around?
Yeah, no. So it's a great question, because we actually don't really know what we'll see, right? We have some ideas of what we'll know we'll see because we've been able to model it and things like that. But I think we're not going to see these kind of big energetic events happening, because the poles of the sun, from what we understand, is like this really open magnetic field line. So there's going to be faster solar wind up there. But one of the key things that we want to observe, and something we haven't been able to constrain, is looking at the magnetic field strengths up there. So we talked about, you know, the solar cycle and the activity of the sun, from, you know, how the magnetic activity of the sun changes and how magnetic field changes over that cycle. But we don't really understand that cycle, right? We don't understand what generates that magnetic field and how it changes over those 11 years. And one of the biggest problems we've had is that we haven't really been able to go and look at the poles and see what's happening there, and to measure the magnetic field there. And also measure what's actually occurring in those coronal holes. So these are these kind of open magnetic field structures. And going back to that study I talked about that was happened this week, of looking at these tiny, tiny events that happen, you know, what happens up there? We haven't really been able to see. And maybe this is going to further help us understand, you know, further what drives the solar wind up there. How does the solar wind change when you go up to the poles? You know, we haven't really been able to measure it too well to date, because we haven't been able to go there. So also, we also have this different viewing angle that we can compare it to Earth, right? So you can actually do some stereoscopy, right? So you have two different viewpoints with two different angles, and you can start to render what the 3D structure of different parts of the sun are. So, you know, it's kind of cool that we don't really know. We have some ideas of what we're going to see, but, you know, we're going where nobody's really seen before. So it's going to be an exciting time for sure.
I kind of don't like myself for asking this question, but I don't ask it anyway. Apart from new knowledge about, you know, the source of all energy in our universe, which is probably useful, is there any practical application for solar science? Can we gain anything from learning more about our sun that we can actually use to help ourselves on this planet?
Yeah. And this is one of the reasons I personally love, you know, studying the sun, is it has this many dimensions, right? As you said, it's very interesting to understand fundamental particle acceleration and fundamental astrophysics in the sun. From another point of view, right, it's also this plasma laboratory in the sky. So we can understand plasmas in conditions we really can't, you know, simulate on Earth. And why this is important is we understand plasma physics, we want to understand tokamak reactors, which is something we have here on Earth. And we can, you know, look at it in extreme dynamics from the spacecraft and look at the sun to then practical applications on Earth to understand plasma physics more. Mm. And then I guess the biggest thing, I guess, that affects us as humans is, you know, space weather, right? So we are orbiting an active star that is, you know, continuously has this stream of solar wind. It has these huge explosions on it. And we are now becoming a society that's more and more dependent on the technological infrastructure that we rely on, yeah, right? You know, anything from GPS to our internet, you know, if everything, our power grids. And we are extremely susceptible to a very, very large event happening on the sun. Yeah. So one of the key things we want to be able to do is to be able to predict when these extreme events are going to happen, because then there are ways to mitigate those effects, right? We can understand what we need to do to our power grids to let more energy flow through, maybe change the orbits of our spacecraft. But at the moment, we aren't very good at being able to forecast these events.
Right.
And
okay,
to forecast them, we need to understand the physics, what is causing them, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of one of the key aspects of, you know, the Solar Orbiter mission isn't a space weather operational mission, but it's informing us about the physics of these events. And with that, then we can build better forecasts. So okay, we want to be in a way of, you know, space or normal weather forecasting is really good here, right? But years ago, if you were in New York, you'd call a guy in Chicago and you'd say, what's the weather like there? And you would expect that maybe in 2 days, that's what it's going to be like, yeah, in New York.
Okay, well, if you would like to hear more, Dr. Laura Hayes from the Dias Dunsink Observatory is speaking, along with lots of other people, all through Irish Astronomy Week. It runs Saturday, March 1st to Saturday, March 8th. More information on her talk and others at irishastronomyweek.ie. Laura, thanks so much. This is Future Proof. It's a weekly science program, and our next guest is not a scientist. His name is Don Ross. He's a professor of philosophy and a behavioral economist. He's at UCC, and he's written this book called The Gambling Animal: Humanity's Evolutionary Winning Streak and How We Risk It All. He joins me now. Don, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jonathan. Happy to be here.
I'm fascinated by your particular sort of animal, the behavioral economist. Can you describe what a behavioral economist does and what sort of thing you get up to, please, for our audience?
Sure thing. Well, I'm co-director of a global risk research lab. So we have we run experiments in multiple countries, in South Africa, where I'm professor of economics at University of Cape Town, and also in Europe and in America. And so what we do is we bring groups of subjects into the laboratory and we present them with sequences of lotteries. So they'll sequence of lottery pairs. So each subject first they'll get one lottery on the left-hand side, they'll get another lottery on the right-hand side, and we'll say, which lottery do you want? These will be lotteries that give them different amounts of real money with different associated probabilities.
Oh, right. So you can get a 1 in 10 chance of winning 100 or a 5 in 13 chance of getting 75 euros. And that sort of idea?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And we give them multiple, they go through whole sequences of these lottery pairs. And we prepare the amounts, both the money amounts and the probabilities, carefully through the sequence in such a way that once they've done 40 or so of those, we can then use that result in combination with another task they do, which I'll now describe. So then another task they do, it's not enough to know which lotteries they've picked. We also need to know quantitatively what their confidence level is about probabilities. So they do another task in which they get 100 tokens, each of which are worth money, and they get a probability array, a line, ranging from 0 to 1 with a bunch of bins, as we call them, 10 bins across that 0 to 1 line. Mm-hmm. And they take their 100 tokens and they distribute them across those bins as they see fit. And they know they're going to get rewarded depending on how bold their conjectures are. So suppose there's going to be a random draw based on the probabilities we give them. It's going to respect the probabilities that we give them, that draw. And they can either, they've got to estimate where they want to put their money. If they can be bold and put all their money in one bin, but then if the draw misses that bin, they get nothing.
Right.
Or they can spread it out around that bin. And so, of course, an unconfident person will spread their tokens around, and a bold person will, sure they're doing the math right, they'll put all their tokens in one bin and take a chance.
Okay.
So we take the lottery choice outcome, we take the this second confidence task outcome, then we do a lot of pretty complicated econometrics.
Econometrics? That's a new one on me. But it explains itself in the word, so I don't need a definition. But yes, econometrics, go on.
Sure thing. It's just statistics built, informed by economic theory. So yep. We do some pretty fancy mathematics, and as a result, if we've got 40-odd pairs of lottery choices and we've got several of these exercises, these confidence exercises, on the basis of that, we can give a full quantitative specification of the person's risk-response profile. So basically, we can give a model of how that person's responses will change as you vary either the prize, the money, or the probability, or both.
Right. So by doing these two tests on an individual, you have a pretty good idea of how they're going to respond to big prize, big risk, low prize, low risk, and so on. And that gives you a kind of a good idea of how risk averse or risk hungry a particular individual is. When it comes to the sort of numbers that you're putting through this test, before we try and understand why you're doing this, how many people have done this and whereabouts? You said you've done this in different countries. How many different people have undergone this particular test?
We've run just over 40,000 people.
Oh my God.
Over the past 10 years or so. And we've run, it's crucial, of course, that you don't just have a bunch of students who are not representative or a bunch of people. And so we've been all around the world. We've done very poor people. We've done very rich people. We've done old people, young people, men, women, literate people, illiterate people, innumerate people. We did a study with Ghanaian fisher people. We did a study with some farmers in the Ethiopian highlands. We did refugees in East Timor.
Wow.
So we've pretty much covered the species pretty well.
Wow. So this is really, really interesting, because now my mind is going to, what does our age or our culture or our poverty level or our numeracy level, what sort of effect does that have on our appetite for risk? So I'm gonna make some assumptions, and you can just tell me, because they would be what people would commonly think. So I'm going to make these assumptions, and you let me know if I'm roughly right or roughly wrong. How does that sound?
Okay.
So you don't sound very sure about this experiment. Just run with it, Don. Just run with it. So I would assume that rich people are more risk hungry and poor people are more risk averse.
No.
Okay, great. Explain that for me.
So here's what we actually... First, let me make a little subtle distinction, and then I'll tell you the main finding that we actually get. So the subtle distinction here is, obviously, you need to control for how desperate a person's worst case outcome is, right? If I want to know a poor person's risk attitudes, I don't want to give them a choice between spending their last dollar, right, and nothing.
Right.
Because they just can't spend the last dollar, I'm not going to find out anything about their risk attitudes, actually.
Right.
So what I have to do is I've got to make sure that the prizes they could win in our lab are calibrated in a way that takes into account where their desperation point is. So we've got to make sure that if it's poor people in the lab, we've got to make sure that the stakes are set in such a way that they'll be very tempted to go for the big prize. And of course, for ethical reasons, nobody ever comes into our lab and can lose anything, right? Yeah. They're choosing between wins and wins.
Yeah.
So we carefully calibrate. We take into account in our modeling what their income and wealth is when we do the calculation.
Right. Okay. Okay.
And what we, in general, no, we do not find a systematic difference between poor people and rich people or between educated people and less educated people. What we do find is, of course, a lot of variety within each population. In every population we've studied, somewhere between 15 and 25% of the people show risk attitudes that are consistent with so-called expected utility theory. That is, they choose in a way that actually maximizes their statistical probable money.
Right. That would not be me, by the way. I would not be maximizing anything. I am so bad with money and so bad with figures. My accountant sends me emails saying, "Dear loser," that's how bad I am with money.
So, Jonathan, you're in the majority. Most people are moderately risk averse. Furthermore, and this is the really important thing, most people subjectively weight probabilities. That is, they don't treat the probability line as if low probabilities are just as likely as middling probabilities. They bet as if tails are fat, right? If both very, very good outcomes and very, very bad outcomes are more likely than middle outcomes.
Yeah.
And so we can model that just fine. The tests that we run with the people tell us if that's their structure. Here's the interesting finding, though. So we find these heterogeneity, as we say, this variation among people. We find it in every population we've studied. But we find roughly the same pattern of variation in every population.
What?
So we take the refugees in East Timor, you take the students at Georgia State University, where our lab is based, you take our main lab, we take financial risk officers from companies, we take all these populations, and with only one exception, we've always found that we get roughly the same mix of risk responses in all those populations. The only exception we ever had, I have no clue why they were an exception. We did a big study of students at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, and they did not show the pattern.
The weirdos at Auckland aside, if you've been paying attention, this is really, really interesting because it sounds like your environment and your general level of income, or these are not factors at all, like the geographic environment, cultural environment, they do not affect your risk-taking behavior, which makes it sound like when we talk about genetics on this program all the time, we talk about, you know, environment and our genetics. And if the environment doesn't shape our risk-taking behavior at all, if you've done this so often in so different places, it's always roughly the same distribution, then it sounds like we all sort of communally have the same distribution of risk within our populations, which means our appetite for risk seems to be mostly genetic?
That's one possibility that is consistent with the data. What I think is much more likely is that there is imagine each person going through life making risky choices, usually in social situations where their risky choices are part, the outcomes of their risky choices are partly a function of the outcomes of the risky choices being made by other people around them, people they're competing with or people they're cooperating with as business partners or spouses, right? And so there are natural equilibria, right? There are stable distributions given the kinds of risks that groups of people face. And people sort themselves into roles within those social equilibria.
Right. So actually, we're very much a product of our environment because we're sort of forced to be that way because of how we all socially interact.
That's, I think, the most likely explanation for this finding. But I do still think the finding is very surprising because, after all, these different groups of people are in very different environments, and one would have expected a priori that there would have been quite a lot of variation in the equilibria across those environments.
So in fact,
I do think it's evidence that the fact that people learn these equilibria so stably and so reliably, I think is evidence that risk responses in people are very, very ancient and deep. That is, I suspect if we could run experiments with people from 40,000 years ago, we'd find the same thing.
Okay. So I find that bit really, really fascinating. The other thing, which you kind of go into the book, which I'm sort of at a loss as to why we've particularly chosen this animal, but you compare humans with elephants when it comes to risk taking. And I'm wondering why elephants and how are they useful to compare to humans when we're trying to understand the risk taking ape?
Thanks, Jonathan. Of course, that's the question I'm most happy to answer. And I should add, before I say anything more about elephants, we have in fact now been running for the last 5 years an adaptation of the laboratory procedures I just described for you with people. We've been running this with a group of African elephants. We're estimating now the risk preferences of these elephants.
Excellent.
Why elephants as a comparison species? Well, the first thing is, why compare us with another species at all? In general, in science, if you're trying to explain a pattern that arises in one case, you need to have a contrast case. Because what you're trying to explain is you've got to have some difference to get a thesis around. So you need, given that we find this common pattern in people, we now need to compare people as a species with non-people. So, well, which non-people? Now, you might think, well, it should be maybe chimps or bonobos, our closest genetic relatives.
Yeah.
The problem with them, there's two reasons not to choose them. One reason is that the very thing that caused our species line to diverge, that separated us from chimps about 10 million years ago, was the fact that they moved into a very different kind of risk. They evolved from there in a very different kind of risk environment than we did. Chimps basically are forest animals, and the sort of risk you encounter as a forager in a forest are really different than the kinds of risk you encounter if you're a mobile species foraging across big distances in a relatively arid landscape,
right,
with relatively little water. So we should expect the risk profile to mainly be a function of the kind of environmental challenge that you face. And humans and elephants evolved under similar conditions with respect to climate risk and geological risk in roughly the same environment. Then they both spread all over the world from there. They both rely strongly on mobility. And here's a really important point. Humans and elephants have similarly metabolically super expensive brains. The elephant brain, I mean, humans' brains is much more metabolically expensive than the elephant brain, but the elephant brain is much more metabolically expensive than a chimp brain. So both species, under similar risk conditions, evolved these really, really expensive brains. Now, we know from natural selection, you won't get anything that's super metabolically expensive unless it's giving you a big payoff.
Yeah.
So with elephants and humans, here we have two species that at roughly the same place and time, under similar challenges, risk challenges, both in both cases, somehow it was worth their while to spend a huge proportion of their calories sustaining these great big processors in between their ears.
Right. So, and in terms of your work then with elephants and risk taking, what do they do? Are they as risk taking orientated as we are?
Well, of course, we confront them with lottery pairs just like we do with the people. So they have to take a risk. Now, of course, as with the people, what kind of risk do they take? In their case, of course, they're not interested in money. So the prizes in their lotteries are apples and oranges.
Yeah.
which to them are terrific. I mean, they don't get them in the natural environment, so that's a great payoff.
How do you set up the lottery for an elephant? I mean, how do they know? How do you communicate risk to an elephant?
Well, thanks for that question, because that's the other crucial one. And let me just, in order to frame the answer, let me just jump one step ahead and say what the policy point of estimating these elephants' risk profiles is. Elephants in Africa are not evenly distributed as a result of human interference. So we've got too many elephants in some places, no elephants at all in other places. Thousands of elephants are going to have to move if we want to sustain the species. Now, how do you get thousands of elephants to move long distances? Well, you can't chase them, scare them, or put them in lorries and drive them around. We have to get them to move the same way we would people. We have to make offers to them. We have to give them the idea that, well, if you go over here, you can get a better deal than where you are now.
Why can't you put them in a lorry?
Because they're too big.
But you can just build a bigger lorry.
Thousands of elephants. Also, if you transport the elephants, they will have no idea why they're where they are when you release them. And they'll try to make their own plan to go somewhere else.
Right.
They'll only stay put if they chose to go there.
Okay.
And we don't want to fence them all in. So we have to be able to communicate to elephants different prospects. We have to be able to say, for example, there's a good option over, 260 miles to the northeast, and there's a good option 430 kilometers to the southwest, and in between is Mrs. Mkhize's watermelon patch, and we don't want it's that's a terrible place to go because you'll have conflict with humans. We need to be able to tell them, communicate those things to them, but obviously in terms that matter to them, like the relative risks of these different options.
Sorry, I'm just confused now. You're talking hypothetically, right? You're not actually proposing that we actually, you're talking about, like, this is a hypothetical thing, right? You're not actually proposing that you teach elephants where to migrate.
No, it's not hypothetical in the least. That is the objective. And so in our experiments step in that direction, because of course, what we have to do in the outdoor lab with the elephants is we have to communicate to them about probabilities of finding six oranges over here or three apples. We have to communicate to them the other lottery prospect. Maybe there's seven apples with a 15% probability or six apples with a 30% probability and so on. We have to communicate that to them. And we communicate using what we call a little language. It's basically sound tones, where the length of the tone the length of the tone is telling them about the probability, and the depth of the tone, the sharpness, the pitch of the tone, is telling them about the number. Actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
So it's kind of like Pavlov in a way.
I didn't state the details of what means what quite right, but let's pass.
Okay, yeah, no, I get
two
it.
Two dimensions of a sound tone, which correlate with quantity and probability.
And presumably they do the test over and over and over again, and they figure out what these things mean.
Exactly, right, they're super smart.
That's very clever.
They're very smart, and they have language of their own. So our experiment will likely be very different in 5 years' time, because thanks to deep learning AI, I think we're 3 to 5 years away from being able to have conversations with them in their own language.
We have to go, but I have to ask this final question. Even if you train them about risks and so on, how on earth are you going to communicate to elephants about things that are hundreds of miles away?
With drones. So the humans will have to, obviously humans are going to have to be deeply involved in all of this, because humans are going to have to rig up the environment so that we know we've got to give them an Easter egg hunt, as it were, right? We need to put food around in the environment so we know where it is, and we've got to program the information to be fed to them. But we are careful to be using sounds that can be emitted from drones. So the idea basically is that the drone could go with the elephants. The elephants will learn very quickly that if they can send up the drone and that the humans have programmed, and that will bring back information. If they understand the sound tones, they'll be looking for those sound tones. We can teach elephants how to manipulate a physical apparatus in a day. They're as fast as humans at figuring that out.
Before, so, we've got to go, Don. But I just don't take this the wrong way. Are you a crazy person, or is this all? Because I don't have time to explore whether or not this is very well thought out. Because it sounds like the plan of an absolute lunatic. Is this actually a well thought out, evidence based approach to migrating elephants?
Absolutely. I mean, it's in the sense that we know a lot about elephant cognition. We know what they're good at and what they're not good at. One of the key challenges that any project for trying to help elephants move has to respect, you've got to give them choices. We can't just lead them around, because elephant social structure is based on the track record of the matriarch and her older sisters and aunts. It's based on their track record at making good decisions. Bear in mind, here's why it's not so crazy. For an elephant, every day's challenge is making a plan. They have very inefficient digestive systems. They can't just walk around and eat whatever they happen to find. They need some of this nutrient and some of that nutrient, and they can't get too far from water. So every day for elephants, they've got to make a plan, and it's what they do. So the situation we're putting them in is isn't weird for them. That's making risky decisions that's their shtick. That's their app.
We must follow up with you along this project, Don, because it sounds absolutely fascinating. If you're as curious about it as I am, you should read his book. It's called The Gambling Animal, Humanity's Evolutionary Winning Streak and How We Risk It All. Don, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, for a great interview.
That's nearly it from us. But before we go, if, like me, you are enthusiastic about the promise of AI but don't know how to get started, I have begun a program helping you to do just that. We have two events coming up: an online event looking at AI tools for researchers and academics to make your life a lot easier, and then we have an in-person bootcamp for SME owners in Dublin, where we'll be fixing your problems in the room. If that sounds like something you might be interested in, you can check out getstartedai.com. That's it from us on the program. Thanks so much to our producer, Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo da Silva. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.